We're now recording, and so I'd like to welcome you all to the Q&A for tonight. And as always, I will go and mute all, and you have the ability to unmute yourself if you want to contribute to the conversation or ask a question, or you can ask it in the chat window. So I will hand it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. And yes, Alan, we see your deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Good evening, everyone. We have quite a packed house tonight, I think, so we'll start right in. And first of all, we're looking for some contributions from people. Anybody who knows about two-dimensional scanners, where you can scan a whole page at once using our camera-type technology, an array of sensors, how to choose security software for your computer and your smartphone, and the different kinds of USB ports. And talking about USB ports, if anybody wants to do some research, there's a ton of information available on the web. Wikipedia has a whole slew of information about different kinds of USBs. And it's quite complicated. There's lots of different types and variants. And if you think it's going to get better as the technology improves, Stuart found a YouTube video about USB 4, which says it's going to get worse rather than better. So it's an interesting thing to take a look at if you're interested in USB materials. Okay, first question tonight was somebody who wants to create a VCF file from the contact on her smartphone to use as a backup. However, the problem is when she creates the file, it only contains one contact, whereas she has a number of contacts on the phone. So she's asking, has anybody encountered this problem where you export the file and you only get one contact instead of all contacts? And people have probably done this. If you go to settings, if you go to contacts and you pull up the settings menu, then you find the export option. And after that, it depends a little bit on the version of Android you have, the type of phone you have, that kind of thing, and what you actually get. And on my phone, I see two things I can do. I can either export to a VCF file, which is what the query wants, or I can share all contacts. And it turns out this thing really does the same thing. If I export to a file, then I end up with a VCF file. If I share all contacts, it creates a VCF file and then asks me how do I want to share it, by email or Bluetooth or whatever. And personally, I've never had a problem. I've exported the file and all my contacts have shown up in the file. So I can't answer the question. Has anybody seen this where you've exported the file and only got one contact? And does anybody have any suggestions as to how to get around it? You have to unmute yourself if you know the answer, or put something on the chat for us.
What operating system are they coming from originally, or what is the source of the data?
It's an Android smartphone.
Are they using Google?
It's an Android smartphone and the contacts app.
Yes, the question is still valid. They could be.
I don't know.
Okay.
Most phones will use the Google app, but they may customize it, I don't know.
Right. The Samsung, for example, uses their own proprietary contact app that syncs with Google but isn't necessary to sync. Okay, my answer is first of all, see if you can get access to the same contacts by logging in on a PC or Mac and going into Chrome. And then from there, export it using either of those from either of those applications, not from the Android app. Now, it's been years since I've last done one, but I do know that what is a very difficult to do over the phone is much easier and works as advertised when you do it from either a Windows or a Mac. So that would be my offer, but unfortunately, the last time I had to do it was 3 to 4 years ago.
Okay. Well, if anybody else has any other information, you can add it in. I just point out an article I wrote a while ago about smartphone contacts. When you do download if you do download it as a VCF file, it's not terribly useful. It's a text file. And it's like an XML file. It has a whole bunch of different fields. But there's free software, or a public domain software, that will convert the VCF file to a comma-separated value file. And then you can import that into Excel and massage it however you wish. And then once you've got the contacts in the order that you want them, there's more software where you can do the reverse and take the CSV file and convert it back to a CSV file. And then you can import that into your phone. So that was the essence of that article, was how to play around with the thing. Now, what we were talking about was the contact database that's on the phone somewhere. And the problem, of course, is that sometimes people use Google's version of Android, and sometimes manufacturers customize things. So where the database actually resides is debatable, and you probably have to search on Google and find your phone and see if anybody knows where it is. If you're running a plain version of Android, sometimes called plain vanilla, then you will find it in the root directory of the phone. It's in data, android.providers.contacts, and databases. Now, the problem here is that for most users, you won't be able to get to it because it is in the root, and to get to the root of the file system, you need root access, so your phone has to be rooted. However, if you have a rooted phone, then you can get to that subdirectory, that folder, and you're looking for this file called contacts2.db. And it's in a SQL database type format, and there's a couple of free programs which are Windows based that you can use to access the file. Now, I happen to have a rooted phone, so here I'm using the root file manager, a special file manager that has root access, and you can see that we're actually directly in the root. We're not on any of the SD cards. We're in the root of the file system. Here's the data folder. And if I go further down, then I go data. Eventually, I can get to this com Android providers contacts folder. And sure enough, there is databases. And if I open that file, I can get to contacts2.db. So now I can download that file to my computer. And I can install this DB browser for SQLite, which looks like that. So I have the option up here to open a database, and I navigate down to the file that I downloaded, the database file, and I try and open it, and it doesn't really work. It says a table in the database requires a special function called phonebook that this browser doesn't understand. And so I can carry on, but be aware, bad things can happen to your database. Well, I don't really care because this is just a copy of my database, so I can say yes and see what happens. And you can immediately see that this is quite a complicated database structure. If I look at the various tables, there are dozens and dozens of tables. And when I scroll down a bit, there are two kind of databases that look as though they're important. Contacts, you would think that would be contacts. It turns out It's not really a very useful table. Really, all the records are in this table called data. The program's not terribly intuitive. If you have to right-click on things to make things happen. So if I right-click on data, then I get a drop-down where I can browse the table, and I can also export the table to a CSV file. So if you have root access and you can download this file, then you can eventually end up with a CSV file, which might be useful. I say might be useful because if you look at the table and I scroll down to somebody we know and love, you see that the database structure is kind of weird. There's all kinds of missing data records. And then there's a bunch of records here, at least four records, something to do with Chris, a couple of emails, and a phone number. But they're all on different lines, which is unusual. I don't recognize that as a database record. Normally, I'd expect to see all the fields for one individual in a single line. And sure enough, if I export that to a CSV file, then you can see that the records are, the fields are as stated. And if you really want to know Chris's phone number, you can't quite see it here, but it's actually here, 1.61 e to the 10. So if you just expand that a little bit, you'll be able to give Chris a call. Anyway, that's my take on Android contacts. If it works, it's really quick and really easy. And if it doesn't work, it can be quite difficult. And I don't see anything in the chat to say that anybody knows any better, so we'll have to take Lawrence's advice and see if that will help our questioner.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along. We had a promise of...
Yeah, I don't see Tom here yet. Tom, if you happen to have come in under a different name, if you could speak up and I'll make you a co-host. But I don't see a Tom or a Trunche.
I don't see him either, so I don't think he's here. All right. You want to just skip this whole section or you want to go to your stuff?
Let's skip the whole section for now. And if Tom comes in later, we can jump back to this point.
All right, let me see if I can do that. And so what I want to do is, come on.
You want to have slide
get down to
26. Sorry, 27.
Yeah. All right, so one of the shares that we were asking for last time was this question of what can you do with Amazon Alexa or Google Assistant. And we had we had two volunteers, actually, who are going to give us some information, and starting with Chris.
Yeah, this is just a little bit of random stuff about the sort of things that you can talk to an assistant like the Google Assistant built into the Google Home system. So one example is just saying, I'll probably stop the first two words so I don't wake up my assistant here and have it yelling at me from another room. So, but you always wake it up with that two-word phrase. And then what time does the LCBO at College Square open tomorrow? And it'll actually respond, the LCBO at 1363 Woodruff Avenue, Unit A, opens at 10 a.m. So kind of neat that you can ask for, you know, when stores open and things like that and not have to either call them or check it out on the web. You can just yell it at your assistant. Another one I found was saying play the sound of rain or forest sounds or ocean sounds. There's a whole bunch of different sounds that it will respond to, and it'll just play back those sounds. So it's sort of a white noise that you can have playing when you're trying to go to sleep. And kind of neat thing is once it starts playing, you can say set a sleep timer for 15 minutes, and then it'll turn off automatically after whatever time you state. You can set a timer for things. I use this all the time for when I throw something into the oven or whatever, and rather than putting a timer on the stove, which means that if I want to check the timer and I'm in another room later on to see how much time is left, it's a bit of a pain. So I can just say set a timer for 20 minutes. At any point, I can say how much time is left on the timer, and it'll tell me you know, how much time is left before it go off. This first one is really cool. Say, find my phone, and it'll make your mobile phone ring. So as long as you're in reasonable distance of the phone, you'll be able to find it quite easily. And this will work even if your phone is on mute. It'll actually unmute your phone and have it ring at full volume. So very good for when you misplace your phone within your house. You can start it ringing and then run around the house listening for the ring. You can have it translate phrases. So you can say, how do you say, you know, a phrase or a word in whatever language you want. Actually, not whatever language you want. I think there's about a dozen that they have currently that they support. But, you know, French, English, Italian, I think German, a couple of others. You can actually make a phone call from your assistant. So I can say call and a phone number, and it'll actually make the call through Google service itself. One thing you have to sort of watch out for that is if you do that, it's not going to be coming from your home number or your cell number. It's actually going to be coming from some other phone number. So if you have somebody who doesn't answer the phone for unknown numbers, they might not answer your call if you do it this way. You can have it define routines, which is kind of neat too. So to do this, you have to have the Google Home app installed in your phone. There's no app for desktop or anything like that. But you can actually define these routines. And so, for example, I have one called I'm Leaving. And when I'm going to leave the house, I just tell it I'm leaving. It tells me the current time, the weather. It turns off my lights that are under light control. It stops streaming music that I might have going on any of the devices. Gives me a traffic report. Lists my upcoming appointments for the day. And finally tells me a joke. Now, the jokes are pretty bad. I'm thinking about taking that one off. It's actually pretty bad puns that they do. I guess they don't want to offend anybody, so they're just really bad puns.
There's a couple of things in the chat, Chris. Corrine wants to know, when you ask it about the opening times for LCBO, then does it say you've been to the LCBO three times this week?
I know, and if it did, I would stop at doing that.
And Bill wants to know if you can change the name Alexa or Google on these systems.
As I read at one point, I think, that yes, on the Google you could, but I'm not 100% sure on that, and I never actually had the desire to do so, but I believe it is possible. I just don't know how.
And Stuart's saying that he was recently reading that people with a home security system are the most likely to adopt a voice-activated assistant. Not sure why that would be, but...
Yeah, the more you use these things, the more that you find them useful. I'm still not ready yet to tie mine into a thermostat or a front door lock or anything like that, that if it got hacked over the Internet somehow, that it could compromise my house. And so I don't mind if somebody comes in, well, I mind, but it's not devastating if somebody comes in and starts turning my lights on and off and telling me jokes. But, yeah, I'm not fully bought into the system yet. For lighting control, where I can turn on and off lights from different rooms or put them as part of routines, I use the Wemo smart plugs. Now, there are cheaper smart plugs than those. It's just I happen to buy one as my first smart plug, and I bought a second one, and I decided to buy a Wemo, only because although you can tie in multiple manufacturers' devices, really what it comes down to is you want to have a smartphone app for every manufacturer. And I wanted to limit the number of smartphone apps that I had to install on my phone, so I just stuck with the Wemo. They seem to work fine. But if you want something else, wherever you're buying it from, like on Amazon or anything like that, if you just look for Works with Google Home or Amazon Alexa, if that's the smart device that you use, and then it'll tie in all the way with it. One thing I just came across recently, which I thought was pretty cool, was a Kazaa Smart Power Strip. So this is a power bar, and it has three independently controllable surge-protected outlets on it, three-prong outlets, and then there are two always-on USB charging ports. I thought about it, and I almost bought it, and then I thought, well, what would I plug into it that I would really want to be able to control through a routine or by voice to turn it on or off? And quite frankly, my power bars, I'm quite happy with them being always-on power. But if you wanted to have it that you could turn off multiple devices plugged into a single power bar, it looks like this would be an interesting device. And I think it was $30 or something like that. Not too bad. Some of the other things you can do, you can have Google remember things. So you can say, remember that my lock combination is whatever. And then you can say, hey, what's my lock combination? This isn't very secure. Anybody could actually come in and say, hey, what are you remembering for me? And it'll read out the list of everything that it's remembering. But if it's something that you just want to remember for a period of time without having to write it down, not a bad idea. Just shout out, have it remember it. And then when you need to recall that particular item, you just ask the Google Assistant and they'll repeat it back for you.
Okay, so our second contributor, I've just unmuted her mic, is Linda, who apparently spends lots of time in the kitchen up to her elbows in flour.
Well, I just thought I'd make a few comments about some of the things that I've used it for that maybe slightly more from the female perspective, but perhaps not. But I think the female perspective of this is not so much that I'm in the kitchen cooking, because I know a lot of you guys do that too. It's the fact that females don't tend to wear our phones on our body all day long. We might have them in a purse or might have it in a pocket if we go out, but mine's anywhere in the house, so it's not easy for me to grab it and necessarily Google or talk into it for weather or whatever, some of the other things that Chris mentioned that I also use it for. But one of the things that I like about it is the hands-free. So I'm in a recipe, I'm up to my elbows in flour or whatever, and I'm trying to have a recipe, and I look at the recipe, and it's a quarter cup, and I can't remember how many tablespoons are in a quarter cup, so I don't know how to cut it in half. It's that kind of thing. Or I'm preparing a turkey, say, and I'm putting the stuffing in, and I'm trying to remember, you know, how many minutes per pound for a frozen turkey versus a fresh turkey, because, you know, I cook a couple of turkeys a year only, that kind of thing. Or I rarely poach eggs. I get the eggs in the pot, and then, oh, crap, I don't remember how long you keep the egg in the pot for to poach it. So I just ask Google Home, and I set the timer. And the timer is great because, well, Chris mentioned that you can ask how much time is left. I like it because when I set my oven timer or my microwave timer, I can only hear those two on the floor I am, on the floor, the same floor they are on, and even then sometimes not. So if I'm upstairs or down in the basement, in my rec room, I can't hear the timer go off. But with the Google Home, you can set it so loud, you can't miss it. And you literally want to turn it off and go up and check your muffins, because otherwise it's going to wake your neighbors. And it's great for travel. You know, I've got my Wemo light set up, and it just, I don't even have to think about it. When I go away, I just know it's going to come on and off random times sometimes or whatever for that. So that's my little contribution.
Thanks, Linda.
We have something in the chat. It's from Lawrence. Hi, to Bill's question, can you change the wake-up name for Google? Hoping I've interpreted the question. The official answer appears to be no. All right. Though I did see an article from June 2019 that says it can change the wake-up word. I felt the same as Chris that it could be changed, but it appears to be a hack versus an official feature. So personally, I would avoid hacks, especially in something that I think would be rather unnecessary. I mean, it might be nice to change it, but not a requirement. So hacking it, who knows what's in unintended side effects you might have. And from Corrine, so Linda, do the neighbors come over for muffins after the alarm goes off? And Linda says, I keep them secret. You don't have to say what the alarm is for. You can just have it that it just plays the alarm.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. For Alexa, you can change the default wake-up word, but you can't change the anything you want. They only give you two other choices, and I forget off the top of my head what they are, but you do have an option. I think one of them is computer, so you can do the same as you do on Star Trek.
Yeah, I think that might be really important for people that happen to have a person in the house named Alexa. and you don't want the device waking up all the time. I hope most people don't have a person named Google in their house. However, I have had it where I'm watching TV and all of a sudden the assistant will wake up and say, I don't understand what you asked, or something like that. And I presume it was something on the TV that it heard and interpreted as being hello Google or hi Google or something like that. Or
yeah, yeah. For a while my main Alexa device is in the same room as the big screen TV. And every time you get an Alexa commercial on there, it would wake up.
Yeah.
And I guess they've Amazon has woken up to that fact. And there's something they do when somebody says Alexa on the TV, it doesn't wake up the device. So there's some fiddling they do there. So it, doesn't upset that.
Oh, that's interesting. Jocelyn just posted in the chat a link that change OK Google is in part of the URL. So if you really are interested in changing the wake up word, it looks like there might be something there.
Yeah, from what I can see, it's you load an application called Mic Plus, and then they give instruction, and you can change that according to the article.
Okay.
Okay, we're moving along. I think this is Stuart, who reads lots of articles. He read one about ransomware protection that's built into Windows. Is this any use, or are there better practices? And Chris had some thoughts on this, I know.
Yeah, it's pasting in something here. Yeah, so control folder access, what it's designed for, it's been around for almost, I guess, about 3 years now. And it allows only specific programs to be able to access or modify files that are stored, modify files that are stored in specific locations. By default, it covers off documents, pictures, videos, so basically all of the old libraries, both the public and the personal libraries, as well as favorites. And then you can add additional folders to that. I wrote an article back in the spring of 2018 on control folder access. It's nice. What it does is it prevents a lot of malware, like file encrypting malware, from being able to encrypt your documents. So it's good for that. It does have some rough edges around it, for sure. Over the major updates to Windows since then, they have refined it a little bit. I took a quick look today. I may write a follow-up article to that. They fixed a couple of things that I complained about in that article from 2018, but there's still some things that I really don't like about the way that it works. So personally, my advice is just make sure you have good backups, including backups that are not permanently connected to your computer, where they could be infected by file encrypting malware as well, and you'll be in good shape to be able to recover anything anyways. But if you want to delve into it, read that article, and then again, maybe I'll have an update article. There are a few changes to it since then. And I've pasted this into the chat window as well there.
Yeah, this was a suggestion from Tom, a program called Configure Defender, which apparently does the same thing, but more easily, as Tom says. So all the URLs are in the chat window there. Okay, our next question is about how do you ensure good battery life for your laptop? You leave it plugged in all the time, or do you disconnect the power overnight, or something else, I guess? And Chris had an idea.
I ran into this problem a number of years ago where I had a laptop computer was my main computer, but it sat in a docking station all the time. And so it was always plugged in. And within a year and a half or 2 years, the battery was completely cooked. It wouldn't hold a charge for more than about 3 seconds. And so it's not a good idea to keep battery plugged in all the time. I did a bunch of reading on it. There's a lot of differences of opinion, but there seemed to be consistency about the fact that disconnecting from the wall periodically is a good idea. And I've heard things ranging from, you know, every couple of weeks or at least once a month. Let it run on battery till it's down to about 30% or so, and then plug it in again. And that should keep the life of the battery in good shape. And I know Alan did the search for the information on this. He came up with the stuff at the bottom on Consumer Reports, where they were actually going to advocating that you don't charge it more than about 80%. And that I find difficult to live with, because you know, you plug your phone in overnight or something like that. You get up at 3 a.m. to say, oh, it's at 80%, I better unplug it. You know, people just plug it in and they leave it plugged in. Most devices will handle elegantly when it gets to 100%, and it will stop so it doesn't overcharge or anything like that. And so that's the way I treat it. I just charge it up to 100%, then I unplug it. I think that's chasing minute benefits to actually unplug it when it gets to 80% charge.
So Karen's asking whether that also applies to phones and tablets and so on.
Yeah, I think it applies to any battery, whatever it has to be in, definitely lithium ion, and I would presume it's as applicable on nickel metal hydride batteries as well.
Yeah, I think if you read some of these postings on this topic, you'll find they say battery technology's changed quite a bit recently, and the old ideas don't work. Now you've got these lithium batteries, and they have this new recommendation, I guess. Okay, so Bernard has problems taking pictures when the phone's in bright sunlight because he can't see the object he's trying to take a picture of very clearly. And he moves into the shade so he can better see the screen. And he says, this is an adjustment to overcome this problem. So I put this to our photographic gurus, that's Chris and Linda, and they both came up with the same main answer, but Chris had a second possibility too.
Yeah, so the most straightforward thing is to brighten the screen to its maximum. And this applies not only to phones, but also small point-and-shoot cameras that just have an LCD screen on the back. You end up with the same problem, especially with backlight and so forth. You get reflection off the screen, and it just washes everything out, and you can't see what's going on at all. Another technique that I've used with point-and-shoot cameras, actually, which I didn't put on the slide here, is that shoot wide. So if you have a camera where you're able to zoom in on something, zoom out wider. You can always crop in later on, but if you crop it in too tight, and then because you can't see that, oh, you chopped off half a person out of your photo, you can't get that person back later on. So shoot wide and crop later if you have to. But brightening the screen to the maximum is the most straightforward approach to try to get things as usable as possible. And then there is the old technique, as you see in the picture there, of 8x10 film cameras where you put a blackout cloth or coat or something like that over your head and the camera, blocking out that ambient light so you can see things clearly. It might look a little bit ridiculous, but you'll get the picture.
So a question that came in recently was go ahead.
No, I just wanted to thank Chris.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, so the next question is if anybody has any experience in maintaining a website using Total Commander's FTP client. This is basically uploading and downloading HTML files in particular to a web server. The individual is having difficulty accessing the files on the host because the window that's supposed to show the content of the remote server doesn't show any files or folders there. So Chris has got some thoughts on this one.
Yeah, I didn't think that the problem was really specific to Total Commander's FTP client. FTP clients are pretty basic tools. I mean, there's not an awful lot of sophistication to them, and any FTP client should really give you the flexibility of adjusting everything that you need to. So it's more likely that it's a problem in configuring the FTP parameters. FTP is a weird protocol. So the first one that you might run across when you're trying to do something like this is presuming that you did put in your username and password correctly, which if you're maintaining a website, you're not going to be able to do anonymous access, I hope. And so you would actually be putting in username and password. Presuming that you got that right, some websites may demand that you only do the authentication over secure socket layers or transport layer security. And so in Total Commander's FTP client, you can see the screenshot of it there for the configuration of a particular connection. There's a checkbox to say use SSL TLS. And if you need to use that or want to use that, check that box and try again. That may solve problems. Now, I don't think that this was the problem the person was having because they said they did get authenticated properly. It's just that when it got to the point where they should be able to access their files on the web server, they weren't able to access them. So they actually got past this particular problem, but I threw this in as a generic problem that people may run into with FTP. The next one is a little bit trickier one, and it's passivity. So the configuration screen for the FTP client built into Total Commander has a checkbox for use passive mode, which is also known as PASV. PASV is the technical term for it. Now, I need to step back a little bit here. So in the next slide, I talk a little bit about why we're going to need PASV. So the way everybody is protected by a firewall, whether it's a firewall that's built into your router or a firewall that's built into Windows or both, the way that the firewall works is that it will allow you to initiate a connection to somewhere else out on the internet. Because you initiated the connection, data can flow back on that connection. If you didn't initiate the connection, the firewall will block the connection. So if something out on the internet is trying to connect to you, the firewall will say, well, you didn't initiate that connection, so we'll block it. Almost by definition, that's an attack, almost by definition, because in FTP normal operation, this gets into one of the weirdest things about FTP that I find. Normal operation with FTP, file transfer protocol, the client, you, initiate a connection to the server. The default is on port 21, and it's known as the control channel. The client, your FTP client software, sends what's known as a port command. The server then opens up a data channel connection to you on a different port. The problem is that the data channel connection is initiated by the server, not by you. And so then it's likely to be blocked by the client's firewall. Now, I say likely because a lot of programs or a lot of firewalls out there understand that FTP does this. And so if you make a connection out on port 21, if a connection request comes back in on port 20, then it says, well, that must be the FTP server trying to communicate with the client, and it may let it through. It may not. It may block it. It really should block it. PASV is the way of getting around this problem. So this one, the client, again, initiates the connection to the server, again, on port 21, the control channel. The client then, rather than sending the port command, it sends PASV command. And basically what it does is it asks the server what port should be used for data channel. The server, over the control channel, which was that first port 21 connection, it tells the client what port to use for data channel. Then the client, your software, does the opening of the data channel connection to the client on the port that was specified, and then everything communicates fine because data can flow back on that because it's your computer that opened up that data channel rather than the FTP server opening up that data channel and connecting to you. That's what PASV is for. It's to overcome that problem of the server opening up a connection to your computer and getting blocked by the firewall. So the next thing, basically that's just a checkbox in the configuration to use passive mode or passive mode and try changing that. The next thing that can come into problematic territory under FTP is transfer mode. FTP was developed in the early days of Unix as a means of transferring files back and forth between computers. Now, if you look at a text file, in Unix, it's a single character is the end of line character. It's a line feed character. In DOS and Windows, rather than just being line feed, it's carriage return line feed. So it's a two character pair that designates the end of line. So when you're transferring files, if you're transferring text files, you want to use text mode. In FTP parlance, they actually in the background call it ASCII, and that may float through to a user interface. So either text mode or ASCII mode. In a lot of cases, you could actually just use binary mode. So if you transfer a file over in binary mode, the server may be able to use it as is. You can test it. If it doesn't look right after you transfer the file over to the web server, then you know that you actually have to make sure that you transfer text files in text mode. All other files, make sure you always use binary format because the actual ASCII codes for carriage return and line feed can randomly appear in any binary file, and you don't want them to actually get translated so that when you're going from your machine, which has carriage return and line feed, and you don't want to translate it into just line feed and vice versa. When you transfer a file from the web server that has just a line feed character in it, you don't want it actually translated into a carriage return line feed pair. If it's a binary file, that'll ruin the file. And in FTP client in Total Commander, you just have a transfer mode automatic is available, and then specifically binary and specifically text. If you choose automatic, you actually have to define the file types that are considered to be text files. So you can put in .txt, .html, .htm, whatever else you want to define as being that. And then after that, it'll just decide based on the file extension whether it should transfer the file in binary format or text format where it'll actually translate between line feed and carriage return line feed. Listening files can be another problem on FTP. There are different ways between Unix and DOS and Windows in how files are actually listed, where you get the file name, the file size, and attributes and things like that. Most FTP clients will handle this automatically with no difficulty at all. Total Commander does actually allow you to specify it. By default, it shows in the screenshot there, use MLSD, I forget what that actually stands for directory listings. And if it's grayed out, and that little black box in the middle is actually what they consider to be grayed out, it's actually going to be in automatic mode. And I've never had any problem with any servers that I've connected to, but if you're not getting directory listings properly, check to see if somewhere in the configuration you have the ability to say how directory listings are handled. Often they will actually specify Unix format or DOS Windows or whatever. And you can actually toggle that, and that may solve problems of not getting directory listings correctly. So if you're troubleshooting problems with using an FTP client, turn on logging. Every FTP client that I've used other than the one built into the command prompt, has the ability to turn on logging. So in Total Commander, you go into the main configuration, you go to FTP, and you just check the box, create a log file. By default, it puts it into the temp directory, and it calls it, TC for Total Commander, FTP.log, and it'll just add all of the conversations that go between your client software and the server back and forth, and then what you do is just try toggling various settings that I mentioned or other things you want to try, and then go look at the log file and see what's in there. You might see error messages popping up that'll give you some clue as to how you want to actually configure various things in there, or maybe something that I haven't mentioned here. And you can look for that particular error message and see if there's somewhere on the web that tells you how to fix that particular problem.
Okay. Any other questions? There is one question in the chat window, Chris, from Stuart. I noticed when I moved the cursor on my screen, and he's talking about the Zoom window, a green shield with a check mark appears in the upper left corner. Does that mean that end-to-end encryption is activated?
No. End-to-end encryption is something that they have just added as a new feature that's available to everybody. It was available to paid subscribers. We can't use it because we record to the cloud. And in order for it to get recorded to the cloud, we can't have end-to-end encryption. We can't have it that the Zoom servers have our decryption key. That's the whole point of having the end-to-end encryption, so that even if they got a court order, they can't respond to it and give away information. So that all that will do for you is if you click on it, it gives you meeting information. So it'll tell you what the passcode is, you know, if you're calling in, it gives you the invitation link and things like that. Actually, you may see more than or less than what I see. Because I started the meeting, I see a lot of information. But basically, it's interesting. It says enhanced encryption is on. But I know that encryption, end-to-end encryption, is not on because otherwise we couldn't record to the cloud.
Is anybody moving the mouse in that window and seeing this green shield with a check mark? Because I don't.
No, the top left-hand corner, it should be.
Okay, maybe.
Bill says he has it too.
I see it.
Okay.
Yeah, Bob Walker here, I see it.
So what does it mean?
It's just meant to give you information about the current meeting. That's all.
Okay.
Just right, like the URL to it and things like that.
Lawrence has a question about FTP. No, I can't get to it.
Yeah, so it says a thought about not seeing the files is that the login you're using doesn't allow you to access those files. I would inquire if the login has root or administrator access to view all files. In the context of this particular question coming out, it was the login for that this person was given for their web server, and they have been maintaining the web server over time, and it's just recently when they switched to a new version of Windows that all of a sudden things weren't working correctly to see it. So it was working before, isn't working now. So I'm presuming that it's a new installation of Total Commander with different default options that are actually causing the issue. I'm guessing. But good point that it could be that you don't have access to view the files over that particular connection. So that would be another generic FTP issue that you'd have to verify if you're having problems.
Yeah, Micheline's got a link here to a Zoom help file which says the green shield with a padlock in the middle would indicate end-to-end encryption. But since we're not using that, you won't see that.
Yeah, we just have a check mark in the middle.
To see the green shield, you have to move the cursor on top of the recording. When you move the cursor on top of it, it opens two more icons, one for the info and one with the green shield.
Oh, it might be dependent on the size resolution of your screen or something like that, too, I guess. I don't know. I find Zoom a little bit weird that way, that things seem to move around in unusual places.
Okay, another question in the chat. We probably don't have the information right now nor the time to deal with it, but Anita is asking, how do you install Hyper-V in Windows 10? So if anybody has installed Hyper-V in Windows 10 and wants to do that as a share next week, I suggest that would be probably the best thing to do with it.
Yeah, I might be able to very quickly tell where it is, because I believe that it's in Control Panel and it's in the Windows Options. So I think it's under, yeah, in Control Panel, if you go to Default, no, not Default Programs, probably Programs and Features, and then turn Windows Features on or off. Hyper-V is listed in there. Now, I'm on Pro. I don't know for sure if Pro is required to have Hyper-V, but if you are on Windows Pro, definitely it is there. So Control Panel, Programs and Features, in the left panel, turn Windows Features on or off, and Hyper-V is in the list.
Anita's saying she doesn't see the option for Hyper-V in Windows Features.
Okay, in that case, it's not part of, you're probably on Windows Home, and I bet you Hyper-V is not included with Windows Home.
Is that any different than, what is it, VirtualBox, the Oracle product?
It's the same technology, it's just Microsoft's version of...
So if you don't have it in the home version, you could always use VirtualBox.
Yeah.
Question from Sue. Can you review your guide to save disk space? I suspect we're going to have to leave that over till next week.
Just a further thing on Hyper-V. I just did a quick Google on it. Unfortunately, you can't enable Hyper-V feature in Windows 10 Home, as it's not supported. You need at least Pro or higher education with 64-bit installation for using Hyper-V. Windows 10 Home Edition does not support Hyper-V.
Okay. So do we have any other questions, Celestia Metz?
Well, next week, first up, we'll try to have if Tom joins us, he had a number of slides on what we think is going to be the ultimate guide to saving disk space. And so all kinds of ways that you can end up saving disk space. So we expected he was going to be here tonight. We had a number of slides, and I had a couple of additions to that. So we'll kick off next week with that if Tom says that he'll be here.
Carl, you have a question?
Yes. Is it possible then somewhere in the newsletter or somewhere else, then we know when the latest update of Windows is safe? Safe to install, I mean.
Well, both Chris and I have done it, so it's pretty safe.
It's the fall releases are, although they're called a feature update, they're really not a big deal. They're more like a monthly update. So it's the spring ones that tend to be the huge releases that tend to be a little bit more problematic. I haven't read anything online in any of the forums that I frequent that people have been having any major issues with the fall release. So I would say it's fine to install it. It goes in very, very quickly, and it's really hard to pick out areas that are changed at all. It's a pretty small update.
Thank you.
Amita's asking why the Cortana app is not available in the App Store.
Yeah.
It was built into Windows.
Well, yeah, but Cortana is, well, I don't know. Cortana is undergoing constant, it seems, revisions and the emphasis that Microsoft is placing on it. Interesting that they don't have it in the App Store, because it is still part of Windows, and pretty much all of the built-in apps like Calculator, Photos app, All of those apps are in the store as well. So if you do manage to uninstall them, you can actually go and reinstall them by going to the store. I kind of would have thought that Cortana app would be there as well, but yeah, interesting that it's not. Anita, are you in a position where you ended up with Cortana somehow uninstalled on your computer or corrupted and you need to reinstall it, or? I'm just wondering the focus as to why you went looking for it in the App Store in the first place. Trying to download from phone. From iPhone. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. So, is this Cortana on the iPhone? Because my understanding was that they were going to make Cortana available on the iPhone. Mm-hmm. Trying to download from iPhone, it gives this error that the app is not viable in your region.
Not available.
Not available. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's one thing that Microsoft does periodically with new features is they only make it available for certain regions. And I think it's because they think that you're not going to get a really good user experience in a different region because, like, Cortana is specifically designed to automate things that may have a lot to do with your region that you are in. So I would guess that is something that will just change over time, that they will eventually make it available for Canada. But you just have to keep an eye out for it, I guess.
And going back to the Windows feature update, Stuart says he got the update this afternoon, took 5 minutes to install it, and apparently it hasn't blown up yet, so it must be perfectly safe.
Well, I was worried. He said boom, and I thought 5 minutes to install, and then his computer blew up.
That's consistent. I mean, you and I also had like less than 5 minute installs, so it's a pretty small update.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it took a little under 10 minutes for me to install, but that was right from the start of the downloading till it was completed. So very, 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 very quick, very small.
Okay, well, we're a couple of minutes to go, so let me just see if there's anything else comes into the chat. But in the meantime, just to remind you that the next club meeting, our monthly meeting, will be November the 11th, Remembrance Day, and we have a presentation by Bob Walker on computers at war. The library's Tech Cafe sessions start up again towards the end of the month, and Lawrence will be giving a presentation on the 23rd of November on scam avoidance and trust. And for us, our next Q&A will be next week, which will be November the 4th. And as usual, if you have questions or all these wonderful topics that you want to share, send us some details at suggestion box and we will fit you in.
Thanks very much for attending, folks.
Yeah, thanks a lot, everybody.
We'll see you next week.
Thank you all. Great job tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. See you next week.
Thank you for the answers. Bye.
Hope it helps you there, Bernard.
I usually follow up on the answers you give me.
Good stuff.